Hello, I'm Theo, and I was the Member of Parliament for Stafford and chaired the UK Birth Trauma Inquiry in Parliament. And I have a beautiful daughter, but like many women, my birth was far from straightforward. I suffered from a traumatic birth after a 40-hour labour, postpartum hemorrhage, emergency surgery for my birth injury, and went on to develop PTSD. And it was this experience that led me to start campaigning nationally on ending the postcode lottery in maternity care. So Breaking the Taboo is a new podcast on women's health. And in series one, I'll be looking at the issue of birth trauma by speaking to affected mums and their families, healthcare professionals and campaigners. So if you, like me, feel like you didn't know where to ask for help, or you felt too ashamed to ask, then I hope you know you're not alone and that this podcast is very much here for you. Please get in touch with us with your stories and your reflections on the show, as we'd love to hear from you. And thanks to our sponsor, the law firm Irwin Mitchell. You can follow me on Instagram at Theo Clark MP, or do get in touch with us via our show website, which you'll find in the notes below. And now on to today's show. Well, hello and welcome to today's episode of Breaking the Taboo. And I'm delighted to do a special episode today called Ask Me Anything, because we've now been running the show for many episodes and we've had a huge amount of listener feedback. And the first thing I'd like to let you all know is some very exciting news that we've received, which is that Breaking the Taboo has gone straight into the podcast charts in the UK, which is really incredible news. So thank you so much to all of our listeners. I'm absolutely delighted that we're in the top five most listened to shows in the country in our category for health. And I think that's a good place to start this episode, to think about why that is. And clearly it's because there's not been enough information out there previously for families who've been affected by birth trauma. So I've been reading through all of your comments, and thank you all so much for sending me in your messages. We've had so many on TikTok and Instagram and X, and also those of you who've emailed me through my website sharing your stories, ideas for future episodes, and particular subjects you'd like us to discuss. So today on the episode, I'm delighted to have as a special guest Kim, who is the Chief Executive of the Birth Trauma Association. And some listeners might recognise her voice, as of course Kim was here on our first episode with Jill Castle, an affected mum, where they talked about an introduction to birth trauma, kind of what it is and what the main symptoms were, both on the physical health and mental health side. So if you haven't listened to that episode, do check it out. It's the first one in the series and it's a really good introduction to the topic. So Kim, thank you so much for coming back on the show today. And I'm afraid I'm going to put you in the hot seat because we've had so many questions in from families. And I think it's really nice for us to respond to some of the questions that they've asked. But just before we dive in, I'm really riveted, Kim, that this show's been downloaded so many times within such a short space of time. So why do you think it is that this podcast has been so successful? Is there just not really much information out there about birth trauma in the kind of public domain? Obviously, you guys are a charity with the BTA that have been running for 20 years, but there didn't seem to be many resources out there when I looked myself as a mum looking for help.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think, you know, a lot of women who come into us say they didn't know anything about birth trauma. Mm. And they find us by just sort of Googling things like, you know, why do I keep thinking about my birth all the time? Or why do I keep having flashbacks? And it's just not very much talked about. I think there's a general feeling that you shouldn't try and frighten mothers by telling them about the things that might go wrong during birth. And so there's this kind of silence. You know, as you say, it's kind of breaking the taboo. There's a bit of a taboo around talking about what happens when birth doesn't go to plan and you feel psychologically affected by it. So I'm so glad that now this podcast is helping to change that. And more women who are absolutely desperate for information are coming to listen to the podcast. So that, you know, that is really good.
Yeah, well, that's a very good place to start. So our first question from one of our listeners is, I'll just read them out. Should I go to antenatal classes, and what should I know before my first baby comes?
Yeah, so that is a really good question. So I think it's really important to try and be well informed before you go into birth, just so you know what is likely to happen and, you know, what might happen so that it doesn't come as too much of a shock for you. And also so that you know what questions to ask, because that can be really hard. This is something you've never done before. So there probably isn't anything else that you would do in life without doing a bit of preparation first. So having said that, it used to be fairly routine for NHS trusts to offer antenatal classes to women, and a lot of them don't do it anymore. If your trust does do it, then I'd say yes, go along. The alternative is private antenatal classes. So people like the NCT, who are the most well-known provider, and they're the providers too. Antenatal classes aren't regulated, so it can be quite difficult to know whether your antenatal class is going to be good or not. Well, one of the main reasons, I think, for going to antenatal classes is to meet other parents, and a lot of people say that was one of the big benefits for them, just meeting other mums and dads before they give birth. And sometimes the quality of information can be really good, sometimes it's not so good, sometimes providers can kind of skip over the more difficult or challenging parts of birth. So what I would say is try and look out for impartial and kind of objective information about birth. The NHS site is actually pretty good. NHS Scotland's NHS Inform site and their Ready Steady Baby leaflet, I would advise looking at, because that's kind of pretty straightforward, easy to read, impartial advice. And the final thing I would do is just talk to your midwife during your antenatal appointments and talk about what your options are and what your risks might be, because your individual profile. I know a lot of people don't like the word risk because it kind of highlights the possibility that something can go wrong. But I think if you think of it in terms of chance, you know, what's the chance that this might happen to me? What is the chance that I might tear during childbirth, for example? What's the chance that I might need a cesarean section? I think those are all good questions to ask before you you give birth.
I think you made a really important point there, Kim, about risks. And something I've, you know, talked about when I shared my own story of birth trauma is that I really didn't understand the risks to myself. You know, someone who had a baby that was 2 weeks late and being an older mother, and I wasn't really talked through what those options were and how it would affect me in birth. So if anyone is listening, I think it's really important also that you write a birth plan and that you have a think, not just about all the things that you want to go well during birth. And I remember, I think my birth plan, I had, you know, I wanted to have a water birth and I wanted to be in the midwife birthing unit, and none of those things happened during my actual delivery. And that was not the case. So I don't think my husband and I had talked about in advance enough about what would happen in a scenario where everything didn't go to plan and it didn't follow what I'd written down. So definitely worth thinking about during pregnancy of having those frank discussions. And if there are any dads listening to the show, we had a specific episode about this earlier in the series where fathers talked about what questions they should discuss with their partner ahead of labour to make sure that in the scenario that you have to become an advocate for your partner, that you know what they want and how to ask for it. So do check out that earlier episode. Fantastic. Well, that's a great first start, Kim. So on to our second question. We have another listener who says, Kim, what is an episiotomy and will I definitely have stitches if I give birth?
So the episiotomy is a little cut that your midwife obstetrician might make on your perineum. And the reason for that is when your baby's born, when the baby's head comes out, you know, your vagina will stretch, but it might not stretch enough and you might tear. So what an episiotomy is about is really preventing a severe tear. So most women, if left to just birth naturally, they'll have a small tear known as first or second degree tear, but sometimes they'll have a more severe tear known as a third or fourth degree tear, and that goes right down into your rectum. And then that is actually, we can talk about this a bit later, but that's something you ideally don't want to happen, and the risk of that happening increases if you're having an instrumental delivery. So an episiotomy is really designed to prevent that, just to give the baby's head a bit more space to come out, and then it will be stitched afterwards. And so all this is done under local anaesthetics. It's not painful, or it shouldn't be painful anyway. There is a bit of a risk in the sense that the stitches might get infected afterwards. You have to kind of keep that area clean. But for a lot of women, you know, an episiotomy will just heal normally. You know, it'll take a few days, but you'll basically be okay. So it's not something to be frightened of, I don't think. You can refuse to have an episiotomy if you don't want one, if it's something that you worry about. And some women say they prefer to tear naturally, and that's also fine.
That's really helpful. And I think it's important for mums to know what the types of things are that might go wrong and might be a kind of intervention. Because I think when you're during labour, it's about the worst time to be presented with, you know, a form to sign or asked to have your consent for something that you don't understand what it is. So I'll make sure on the show notes that we include some links to sort of useful websites for mums to know their rights. And there's a number of organisations out there like Make Birth Better, and they can really kind of inform you on your choices ahead of childbirth to make sure that you have the right information before you give birth. Okay, so the question number three I have in from a listener on Facebook is, what is induction and should I agree to it?
This is a really difficult question, actually, because whether you agree to it or not, it's really your own decision. But induction is a way of artificially starting labour. There are a couple of reasons to do it. One is if your baby is late, because once your pregnancy goes over 40 weeks, there's an increased risk of stillbirth. And the longer you go over 40 weeks, the more that risk increases. It's not a huge risk, but it is an increasing risk, and it's worth bearing in mind. Doctors will often advise you to induce your baby once you get to 41 weeks. You know, there are other reasons as well to induce. For example, if there's concern about the baby or there's concern about the placenta, what happened in my case, which was that my waters broke but labour didn't start. Because if that happens, your waters break and your contractions don't start, then there's an increased risk of infection. So there's a whole number of reasons you might have an induction, and it is becoming increasingly common. So and the way it works generally is that they try and start induction through a pessary in your vagina, or a gel that has hormones that will get the labour going. They might also later on give you oxytocin on drip, which is artificial oxytocin, and that kind of gets the contractions going. And oxytocin on can make the contractions quite intense. So there is concern with induction that it can make labour more painful. It can also increase your risk of instrumental birth. It doesn't increase the risk of cesarean. It's one of those situations where there are pros and cons, really. There are risks to doing it, there are risks to not doing it. And so really it's something each woman, I think, has to discuss with her midwife or obstetrician, because there aren't always easy answers.
I think it's important that mums know what induction is, because one of the earlier questions you just answered, Kim, was about antenatal classes. And to be honest, I did do a private class and it wasn't discussed at all. When I asked about complications or things going wrong, it was basically completely glossed over. And I was, you know, told that everything would be fine and they would follow my birth plan, and it was very unlikely. So if you are concerned and you don't know what an induction is, there's a couple of useful books that you can read, and I'll pop some links to some useful resources in the show notes. So that's very helpful. Okay, on to the next question, which has come in on TikTok, which says, should I have an epidural during labour for pain relief, and will this reduce the likelihood that I end up getting birth trauma?
So this is a good question, and I think the answer to that is you don't really know until you're in labour how painful it's going to be. So some women go into labour absolutely convinced that they don't want an epidural, and then they find actually labour is so painful that they do end up having an epidural. I mean, as a woman, they go through labour, they don't feel they need an epidural, they manage to cope, they have other forms of pain relief, that's absolutely fine. So I think don't make any decisions until you actually go into labour, just keep your options open. The advantage for a lot of women having an epidural compared to the forms of pain relief is it completely takes the pain away. You don't feel anything. And for me, when I had my baby, I had a very long labour. I had a oxytocin on drip, which really made the contractions very intense. And I found an epidural just completely took all that pain away. Some women find, unfortunately, that they are denied epidurals. So some hospitals have policies where they won't give an epidural before you're in active labour, which is about 4 centimetres of dilation. And some hospitals have a policy as well where they won't give you an epidural when you're very far advanced in labour, so you're more than 8 centimetres dilated. And then, you know, we also hear stories of women being told things like, oh, yes, you will have an epidural, the anaesthetist busy, the anaesthetist will be here soon, and they're just kind of constantly fobbed off, and then they find, unfortunately, that the anaesthetist was never called. One of the things we find is that that can be a really common cause of birth trauma, that women would asked for an epidural and denied it. They found the pain extremely intense and difficult to cope with. And then they feel betrayed as well, that the people who are caring for them actually didn't respect their request enough to actually give them what they wanted. And I suppose the one thing to add is there are risks to an epidural as well. Particularly, you can get headaches with an epidural. And, you know, there are a couple of other risks that, you know, extremely rare. But I would say on the whole, it's a relatively safe procedure. And if you want it, then you should be given it.
Yeah. And I totally agree with everything you're saying there, Kim. I had an epidural during the birth of my daughter. And oh my gosh, having that pain relief just made all the difference between being able to get through and have a natural birth. So I think the important point for listeners listening today to the show is that there are quite a lot of different options that you might be presented with during birth on pain relief. So do research your options and importantly, think about in advance what you'd like to do. And I think, Kim, you made an important point there that what you think you want and what might actually happen during the birth might also be a different thing. So be prepared for that too. And that leads on very well to the next question, which I chose because I think this is a really important point, which is number 5 is, what are my risks in childbirth as an older mum? I don't feel like anyone has told me what they are, but I'd like to know.
Well, there are quite a few risks as an older mum, actually. And, I speak as an older mum myself. There are various complications you can have as an older mum that the risk just increases. So preeclampsia, gestational diabetes, premature birth, postpartum hemorrhage, eclampsia, poor fetal growth. You know, a huge range of things, actually. Of course, the thing about risk is just because your risk has increased a bit doesn't mean these things are going to happen. It's just you have a risk that is higher than it would have been if you'd given birth when you're younger. So I think it's just a question of being aware of that, really. Don't think because I'm an older mum, these things are definitely going to happen, because they're not. It just means being aware that maybe you're a bit more likely to have those things happen than you would have been otherwise.
I think that's a really good point. And anyone listening out there, you know, I had my daughter in my late 30s, and I think it's just really important to be informed. And hopefully one of the objectives with this podcast is that it's giving you all the tools and information that you need so that you can make these decisions. And when I was reading through the many questions, actually, that we got sent in for today's episode, I was interested to see, Kim, how many times risk came up actually as a question. And I think it begs the point about, you know, why is it that we don't discuss risks with mums in enough detail? Because I personally take the view that, you know, as a future parent, I want to know what could go wrong so that I can plan and prepare. And I think we should treat women as adults, and we should allow them to make decisions for themselves about their own bodies. And I think that's the point of this show, right, is to talk about the difficult topics that maybe no one else is, and to break that taboo by sharing this information. So I had a sort of related question on this about risks, which was about the types of birth interventions. So people want to know, like, about forceps or ventouses, and if they're being offered different options, how can they make an informed choice in that moment?
It's quite hard to make an informed choice in the moment, because if there's a medical emergency, you're not going to have enough time to think, I wonder if I should have a forceps, or maybe ventouses would be better, or maybe have a cesarean. And actually, the chances are your caregivers will have a very strong opinion as well about what they want to do. So it's a difficult thing to do in the moment. So the best thing is to inform yourself beforehand if you can. The main instrumental interventions are, or at the moment there are really only two instrumental interventions. One is ventouses or suction, and the other is forceps. And they're used if the baby needs to be delivered quickly. Usually at this point it's probably too late to do a cesarean, because the baby's so head is down in the birth canal, but you need to get the baby out quickly, maybe because the baby is distressed. And so what Von Tooze does is it's a little suction cap that fits on the baby's head, and it makes it easier for the doctor to pull the baby out. There are some risks to Von Tooze. It can occasionally harm the baby, and unfortunately. That doesn't happen often, but it can happen. Forceps, which are a bit like sort of salad tongs that are used to grip the baby's head and pull it out. There are lots of different types of forceps, and they tend to be riskier, particularly for the mother. So they can increase the risk of third or fourth degree tearing. And then there are sometimes risks to the baby as well. So the baby can end up with forceps marks on its face. Forceps, we hear quite a lot of traumatic forceps stories. I suppose the other thing to say about forceps is they can also be used to rotate the baby. If the baby's in the wrong position, you can get rotational forceps, and they carry some risk as well. And our own experience is that we have more women come to us with traumatic forceps births than with traumatic Von Tooze births. And I think it's quite hard, actually, because obviously forceps can be life-saving for the baby in an emergency, but they can also be very traumatic as well. So I think it's kind of worth bearing that in mind, really, and just kind of reading up, really, on the risks of forceps, risks of Von Tooze, what you might like to happen if there is an emergency during birth.
I think that's such an important point. And actually, that reminds me, Kim, when I was doing the birth trauma inquiry in Parliament last year, that we received a lot of evidence from families who'd had birth injuries because of having a forceps delivery. So I think my point on the show today is, hopefully, you know, you're going to have a very good birth. I don't want to scare mums who are pregnant listening to the show. And, you know, the vast majority of people will have a good experience in the hospital, and they'll have a healthy baby and go on to, you know, have no issues at all. But this show is very much focused on, you know, that small proportion of the public who do have challenges, whether it's on the mental health side or on the physical health side. And if you missed our earlier episode, we have a whole dedicated show specifically about birth injuries. And we have a fantastic charity with their chief exec from the Masick Foundation, who's come on with an affected mum. So if you're specifically interested in birth injuries, do check out that earlier episode, because it's got some really practical advice in there and some more information on this subject.
Imagine being told your son would never be able to walk or talk. When we didn't know where to turn, Erwin Mitchell were there.
Our legal and financial experts understand the impact of a serious injury. We help our clients receive the best possible medical care, rehabilitation, and compensation.
My son is now 12. He can walk, he can talk, and he makes me so happy.
At Erwin Mitchell, we'll help you to imagine what's possible so nothing feels impossible. Authorised and regulated by the Solicitors Regulation Authority.
And Kim, we've got a related question that's also come in on social media about this point, and it's asking about what is a fourth degree tear living with incontinence day to day. And so could we just say a bit about that for people who are less aware about birth injuries and kind of what they are?
Yes, of course. So as I mentioned earlier, you can, as your baby's head comes out, sometimes, you know, the perineum, which is the area between your vagina and your anus, that kind of can occasionally tear, you know, as your vagina stretches. And so first and second degree tears are fairly minor, but and will normally sort of heal quite well. And third and fourth degree tears, a third degree tear is in the muscle that goes into the anal sphincter, and then fourth degree tear extends through the anal sphincter and into the rectum. And so that's the most severe type of vaginal tear. And so the really important thing with these kind of severe tears is that they get repaired straight away, because if they're repaired straight away, then there's a really good chance of recovery. If it's not repaired straight away, often because it isn't diagnosed immediately, then it can cause severe problems. So urinary incontinence, bowel incontinence, it can be very painful. You might find it having sex very, very difficult because it hurts too much. And all this then makes it kind of very difficult for women to kind of go back to work, have a normal social life, because they're constantly worried, you know, about the need to go to the toilet. So this is a really big concern. So it's really important, you know, to have the tail like that diagnosed early. And the other thing I would say, actually, sometimes if you have one of those severe tears, is it increases the risk later in life of having a prolapse, which is when either your bladder, bowel or womb drops down into the vagina because the pelvic floor muscles have been weakened. I would repeat, you know, Theo's advice, if you think this has happened to you, to talk to Mazik, because they're a very good charity, but also to go to your GP and basically pester your GP until they give you a referral.
And what's so interesting about listening to what you just said, Kim, is I had literally never heard of a prolapse or a fourth degree tear before I had my daughter and suffered a birth injury myself. So I think it's really important that families out there do know what these things are. So firstly, if they start displaying similar symptoms, they know something's wrong and to ask for help, but also that they know where to get the help. And that's why, you know, we've got a program show website and it's got loads of links to really useful charities and groups out there. So do check it out for information. And I'm struck also when you mentioned then about painful sex, Kim. I mean, we did an episode on that earlier in the series and it had a phenomenal response from viewers. And I think it's because nobody talks about it. So, you know, I remember my first appointment at the, you know, GP checkup after sort of 6 weeks. And I think the first thing I was offered was contraception. Think of anything worse than having sex as having had my baby in a really difficult traumatic birth. So I was really struck that that was really the only thing they talked to me about was you know, not having another baby straight away, but actually nothing about living with painful sex and how difficult it was. So if anyone's interested in that topic, do listen to that specific episode about kind of pelvic health and physio and what to do about that, because we've got some really good experts to speak about that. Okay, so we are whizzing through number 8. We have, and this is a really sad question, actually, which is, am I a bad mum if my baby cries all the time and I can't comfort them? What should I do? And I so related to that question. Gosh, I mean, the amount of times I felt like a failure, for, you know, not being able to breastfeed or not being able to calm my baby down. So what advice do you have, Kim?
I think this is such a common problem. It does sort of break my heart a little bit reading that, because women think they're a bad mum because their baby won't stop crying. And really, you're not. You're really, really not a bad mum, because some babies do just cry a lot, which I know is probably not very helpful. But, you know, I found this as well. You know, that what do you do? And you get this advice of check the baby's nappy, you know, wind the baby, this kind of thing, and nothing works. And a lot of babies, especially the sort of 3 to 4 month point, get colic. And again, nobody really knows what colic is, but it seems to be abdominal pain, and it seems to be sort of related to the baby's ability to digest milk. So the one thing I would say is really that this passes, and it's not just something that happens to women who've had traumatic births. A lot of women find this with their babies. And so I would say, you know, do all the things like, you know, cuddle your baby, feed your baby. But if your baby doesn't stop crying, it's really not your fault. And eventually it does get better. I think that's the one thing I would say about new motherhood to everybody, really, is it does get better, and your baby won't still be crying constantly by the time it's a year old. And you have the next challenge in parenthood, but it's really, really not your fault. You know, this idea that, like, if you're a mum, you'll recognise your baby's different cries. You know, this is how, you know, you recognise, this is a cry that means my nappy's dirty. You know, this is a cry that means I'm hungry. I was never able to do that. I mean, I don't, you know, she just sounded, all her cries sounded the same to me. And I, you know, I've spoken to other mums who've said that as well. You know, ultimately, your baby will love you. I think that's the other thing, really. One of the things that women with birth trauma often say is they think their baby doesn't love them, but actually your baby does love you. So just keep going. I think it's the only advice I can give. Just sort of keep going through it, really.
I think that's such important advice, Kim. And if I can just add to that, you know, motherhood is not a pass or fail. It's not an exam. You know, it's a process. It's a period in your life. And I think when I was reading the, you know, questions coming in from listeners, I was so struck by a lot of them obviously wrote comments around their questions. And, you know, especially with a newborn baby, you're so tired. I mean, I have never had such sleep deprivation and exhaustion in my whole life, you know, trying to get up and feed your baby every few hours, you know, you're just completely broken. So I think don't be so hard on yourselves. And there's a brilliant book that came out by Lucy Jones called Matrescence, where she talks all about becoming a mother. And she's one of the guests we've had on this series, where she talks about kind of the expectations of being a mother in society today. And it's okay if everything is not, you know, rosy and perfect and everything that you thought it might be from kind of society's expectations. But, you know, being a mum is hard work and it is tiring and it's exhausting, and you're all doing the best that you can, and good enough is just okay. So I just want to kind of repeat that point to listeners because it's so important. And actually a related point to that, Kim, about the not being able to comfort your baby is also this point about, you know, failing to bond with your baby. And I know a lot of mothers who've written to me to share very bravely their traumatic birth stories for my book have talked about kind of failing to bond with their baby and not having the moments that they thought they would have when their newborn arrived. So could we just talk a bit about that and any advice for mums who are struggling with the same?
It is really hard, and it is very common amongst women who've had traumatic births that they don't feel they've bonded with their baby. And that, I think that's particularly the case if your baby is taken away from you after it's born, or sometimes if you're so out of it when the baby has been born, or in some cases, you know, some women give birth under general anaesthetic and the baby's presented to them and they think, you know, is this baby mine? And I don't even recognise it. So that, well, there's that whole issue of when the birth has been difficult and you feel really ill and exhausted, you might not spend time with the baby in the first few hours after it's born. And women don't feel they've bonded with a baby. And our experience is, you know, that most mums want to be good mums. And so that even when you haven't bonded with your baby, women tend to try really, really extra hard to be a good mum. We sort of keep finding this. They do all the right things. They might not have bonded, but they behave as if they've bonded. And so what I think what I would say is that, you know, if that happens to you, it doesn't mean that you're a bad mum. You're not going to hurt your baby, because it's not like these stories you hear of babies abandoned in Romanian orphanages where they're not getting any love. Actually, your baby's been well looked after, you're doing the best for it. Quite often there's a partner, you know, there's extended family who are also looking after the baby. And what we tend to find is the women often say they fall in love with their baby a bit later. You know, maybe the baby's 8 months old, you know, maybe the baby's 2 years old, but at some point you will fall in love with your baby. And we know when that happens, all those early days seem much, much less important. So I think just keep at it, really. I think that's the main thing I'd say there.
Yeah, and we heard that actually from other mums who've been as guests on the show in previous episodes. I remember when Jill came on the show with you previously, Kim, in our very first episode of the series, she talked about the difficulties in those first few months and when she thought she'd been a failure and a bad mother. But it did change over time and as she started to recover. So I think the point is, you know, don't beat yourself up. You're not a failure. And, you know, it does get better with time, and do ask for help if you need it. Okay, so next we're going to go on to a different set of questions. I had loads of submissions about mental health, probably because we did that dedicated episode where we talked about that with a psychiatrist and a mum who'd had PTSD. And I know this is something you know quite a lot about, Kim. So first off, we could just talk, for those people who are not aware that mums can suffer PTSD post-birth, do you want to just explain a bit about that and what the symptoms might be? And then we can go on to the question.
Yes, so the research suggests that about 4-5% of women develop post-traumatic stress disorder after birth. So that's quite a lot of women, probably about 25,000 to 30,000 women a year in the UK. And when you get PTSD after birth, it's the same set of symptoms as if you had PTSD from something else, you know, from being in a car accident or being assaulted or being in a war zone. And I think Dr. Rebecca Moore talks a bit about this. There's sort of four categories of symptoms. So the first category is kind of revisiting the trauma mentally. So that can be in the form of flashbacks or nightmares or intrusive thoughts, where your mind keeps going back to the moment of the trauma. And then the second is avoidance, where you sort of you avoid anything that reminds you of the trauma. So you might avoid going to hospital appointments, for example. You might avoid other women and babies. And then third one is a category called arousal, where you feel on a sort of sense of high alert, really. You're kind of constantly anxious. You constantly think something bad is going to happen. And then the fourth one is something called negative cognition, which are sort of feelings of guilt and low mood. Those kinds of symptoms can be very debilitating because essentially you feel as if you're still reliving the trauma. I think that's the kind of really important thing to say about PTSD. It's that the bad thing that happened to you is still in your short-term memory rather than your long-term memory. So you kind of constantly feel as if you're reliving it. And quite often with flashbacks, you won't just get the visual sense of remembering what happened to you. You might get the smell and the sound as well. And sometimes hearing those sounds again, or, you know, maybe having the smell of, you know, the disinfectant they used in the labour ward, or whatever it is, that can take you right back to the trauma. Trying to live with that and get through all that while you're looking after a newborn baby can be intensely difficult, and that's where therapies come in. And, you know, the two major ones used for PTSD are trauma-focused CBT, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, which are both very, very effective therapies, and their job is really to kind of move that memory out of your short-term memory and into your long-term memory so that it's no longer ever present for you on a daily basis.
Well, that's actually the question I was going to ask him, because the question for the mum was, what are the different types of therapies available for PTSD? She specifically asked about those two. So do listen to that episode with Dr. Rebecca Moore if mums haven't heard it, because she's a psychiatrist who specialises in birth trauma, and she goes into a lot more detail about the four types that Kim's just mentioned. And Kim, I did both of those two that you just described, EDMR. And interestingly, for listeners' backgrounds, you know, some of you might be like me and think, you know, I don't want to do therapy. It's not for me. I'm afraid I was in that category, Kim. So I, you know, really didn't think that I needed help. It was actually my husband who said, you know, you're really displaying symptoms of PTSD and you need to get help post-birth. And he was the one that encouraged me and said, you know, you need to go and get specialist help. And I was referred to a very good service in Staffordshire through the NHS called the Lotus Service. I think that's an important point for mums to know about how they get access to help. So what are the kind of pathways, Kim, of how they can get referred to a specialist?
Yeah, so there are a couple of pathways. So in England, we have NHS talking therapies, which I suspect is what you had. I suspect that's what the Lotus Service was. And you can self-refer to those, and, you know, you can usually just do that over the website. And generally, they will offer trauma-focused CBT or EMDR. So definitely worth doing that. There are also perinatal mental health services all around the country, so England, Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland. And you can usually, again, go to your GP or your midwife for referral to those. And in England, they're available for up to 2 years after birth. I think in other parts of the country, they're available only for 1 year after birth. And then finally, in England, you have something called maternal mental health services. It's all quite confusing, really, because they are these different pathways and they're overlaps. And I think sometimes even the NHS doesn't really know which pathway. But maternal mental health services came into being a few years ago. And the idea was specifically that they would address baby loss, tocophobia, which is fear of childbirth, and birth trauma. And so if you're lucky enough to be in an area where there's a maternal mental health service, that's a good option to go for. And again, you would need to go to your GP or midwife or health visitor to ask for a referral.
Yeah, that's really helpful advice. And I'll make sure we've got some links, things like the Maternal Mental Health Alliance, which has got useful things like, you know, putting in your postcode, for example, to find local services in your area, because that's something a lot of mothers have messaged me on social media to ask. Is that, you know, Google's so confusing, they just don't know where to look for help and where is like an accurate service they can do. So I'll make sure we put up some links to that. And gosh, we've got so many questions, Kim. We're not going to get through them all today, but if I could just pick kind of a last two, and then maybe we'll have to do another episode to cover some more, because so many are coming in every day. So we've got a question here about breastfeeding. This is very interesting and obviously very controversial. I know everyone has lots of different views, but the question is, I'm feeling the pressure to breastfeed, but I've been unable to produce milk after a traumatic birth. What can I do?
Yeah, I mean, this is really common that women who've had a traumatic birth find it hard to breastfeed and their body just doesn't produce enough milk. And that's particularly the case if you've had a postpartum hemorrhage, because you've lost a lot of blood and you do need blood to make milk. This is so difficult because so many women feel that they failed if they have a difficult childbirth. I mean, completely wrongly, because it's not your fault. And then they think, well, okay, I'll do the right thing. I'll breastfeed my baby. And then they can't breastfeed and they feel they've failed again. So psychologically, it can be really devastating. And I think it's not helped by the attitude of the NHS, which is often you must breastfeed. And then rather than being supportive about it, you get very poor breastfeeding support in hospital. They kind of tell you you need to breastfeed. And sometimes, you know, you hear these stories of midwives just jamming the baby's head onto your breast and it not being successful. I think that just makes everybody feel a lot worse. So I think what I'd say is, and if you want, I mean, there are two options. If you want to sort of try and pursue breastfeeding, then you can sort of try and get help and advice elsewhere. For example, the breastfeeding council, the NCT breastfeeding counsellors, in my experience, were very good. If you don't want to breastfeed and you feel okay, I'm going to try something else, then actually, you know, formula can be a lifesaver. And a lot of women, once they made that decision, right, I'm not going to breastfeed, I'm going to move on to formula. It works perfectly well. The baby feeds well. And, you know, the one thing I would say is when you look at adults around you, you can't tell who's been breastfed and who's been formula fed. You know, I mean, I breastfed my daughter, but I think this idea that you're somehow disadvantaging your baby if you're formula feeding it, well, actually, you know, ultimately you'll most certainly have a healthy, thriving baby, and don't beat yourself up about it. So, and you know, at the end of the day, it's nobody else's business either. You do what you want. You do what's right for you and your baby. And actually, if you're going to be a happier mum, better mum, if you're formula feeding, then that's what you should do. Because I do, a happy mum is happy baby. It's a bit trite, but I think there's certainly an element of truth in it.
That's so true. And if I could just add to that as well, for people listening to what Kim's just said, you know, I also had to do combination feeding where I did a bit of both. So, you know, I was really keen to try and breastfeed my daughter. And I'd heard obviously so much about all the nutrients that she'd get from having my milk. But to be honest, because I'd had a traumatic birth, I could never actually produce enough milk for her for the feeding that she needed, because it took me so long to recover from surgery after the birth that I just never produced enough. And I think those first few weeks, I really beat myself up and was like, you know, I failed as a mum, and, you know, I wanted to do this and I've not been able to do so. My body's failed and it's not producing what it should as a new mum. And actually, I just used to top up with formula. So I'd give her what I could, and that was good enough. And then I'd have to top it up with formula when she was hungry. So there's lots of options out there. I think the point we're both trying to say is do what's right for you. Don't feel the need to, you know, be pressurized by anyone else or by family or friends. You know, everyone has an opinion on this subject, but ultimately you choose what's right for you and your baby, and you'll know what that is. And if you need to get help, you need to do top up, whatever it is, then that's fine. Okay, we're actually running out of time, Kim. So one final question for today, and we'll definitely have to come back to more questions on the list. So, oh, great one for me. The question is, you know, why is women's health not talked about enough or prioritised by the government?
Well, this is a great question. Yeah, where to start? I mean, one interesting thing to understand is it's only very recently, 2022, that we've had a female health secretary. All those years of women being in parliament, and until that point, we had never had a female health secretary. And I think this is, you know, again, until you, Theo, did your parliamentary debate on birth trauma, there'd never been a parliamentary debate on birth trauma. So, you know, for hundreds of years, parliament has been dominated by men who are not particularly interested in women's health. And I think there's kind of this sort of ingrained misogyny, really, you know, maybe an intentional misogyny, but ingrained misogyny in the health services and in policymakers' attitude towards women's health, that they don't really consider women's health important. And, you know, a couple of years ago when the government did a consultation on women's health, they had 100,000 responses because so many women wrote in because they had awful experiences, you know, with endometriosis or, you know, breast cancer or gynecological problems or, you know, traumatic childbirth, all those things. And people just weren't taking any notice of them. So it's really, really time for a change. And I think, Thea, your podcast is a really important part of making this change. And I think we all need to be putting pressure on Wes Street in health. secretary, so that when we have this new 10-year plan for the NHS, that women's health is included in that and it's included as a priority.
Well, I totally agree with that. And, you know, having been a former politician, I remember when the previous government published the Women's Health Strategy, and I just assumed it was kind of an annual document and it was the update. And then I remember reading about it for a debate and discovering it was the first time ever that a British government had actually written a bespoke women's health strategy. And that made me think, gosh, for hundreds of years, it just shows that women's health has traditionally been ignored, really, by policymakers. So I hope by doing this show and me talking about it when I was in Parliament has kind of made the difference to women feeling listened and heard. And we will absolutely keep the pressure up. You know, I'm supporting the all-party parliamentary group in the House of Commons on birth trauma, and we're keeping up our cross-party campaign to implement the recommendations of the birth trauma inquiry. People who are not aware of that, that was a big piece of work that I did last year with my former MP co-chair, Rosie Duffield, who is the Labour MP for Canterbury at the time. And we did a big investigation really into birth trauma and sort of maternity care services across the UK, looking at this postcode lottery. So for anyone who's interested more on the policy side on kind of maternal health, do check out that report from the APPG. Well, Kim, gosh, the time has flown by and we've only covered some of the questions that have come in. So firstly, can I say to listeners, you know, thank you so much for getting in touch. A huge number of you have also shared with me your story. And I think sometimes it's the first time you've done so. So I just want to say thank you for being so brave. And it's really important to know that there is help out there. Kim runs a fantastic charity. If you don't know the Birth Trauma Association, they have a really active Facebook group and they have access to so many resources. And if you've not listened to any other episodes in this series, there's some really good topics out there on, you know, mental health, birth injuries, support for dads, lots of specific topics. So do listen to whatever you're interested in. And if you've enjoyed today's show, then please do rate us on Apple iTunes. Make sure that you share it with friends and family and colleagues who've been directly affected. And please do get in touch again with more topics. I do read all the comments coming in and it does inform future episodes for what we're going to record. So Kim, can I say thank you so much for coming in to record an episode of Breaking the Taboo. And what fantastic news that it's being listened to so widely across the country. And it just shows that there is such a need to break the taboo by speaking about this. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks very much for having me, Theo.